Yes, it's very interesting that McLuhan said advertisement is the biggest art form, because packaging became so important. It has to, a product has to compete with so many different products that the packaging influences the consumption, not the product itself, but how attractive this package is more important than the product itself.
Right.
And this become trash as soon as you open it. To use the actual product is trash, and well, yeah, he mentioned this packaging, and I think one of the directions, for example, here in Berlin, there are new supermarkets where the people have decided. Sometimes you get more packaging than the actual product you are buying. So they don't want this packaging, this trash anymore, and they bring their own bags and jars. And
right.
They just buy the loose product. They want to consume.
Is that pretty widespread in Berlin?
No, it's only one supermarket is here in my neighborhood, and I've heard there's another one in Kreuzberg. But I think it's a trend that might become more popular.
Yeah, the garbage man is obsolete. The people are going to change the ideal of being a janitor. They are going to be the janitor. With their own containers, their own bags. You know, the phrases that came in with the late 60s, getting your shit together. people more
one.
And more, what?
I remember that one, get your shit together, man.
Yeah. Now, isn't it interesting, right in the language, right when he's writing this, that became a common phrase around 69. The word shit is rudely being overused, and to actually talk about to get your shit together, that's shoring the fragments of your ruins, the T.S. Eliot line. I'm going to take my garbage ideas and the garbage experiences I've had and turn it into art. I'm going to get it together. But the fact that everything was becoming garbage, that's why the slang picked up on it and said, we don't have a problem with you getting your shit together. We don't have a problem. We call your stuff shit, and we don't care if you call us shit. We agree. It's all shit. That word got used a lot after the late 60s. Word shit. Just like tattoos are used a lot by people today. But if you lived back in the... Well, you guys didn't, but if you live way back there... It was quite shocking to hear people use the word shit so much, right? You know, yeah, you know, like an executive. You know, Rockefeller probably did it every now and then. Nelson, David says, Nelson, I got to get out of here. I got to get my shit together. And Nelson said, yes, it is a garbage apocalypse. You've read your McLuhan, right? The latest news line, all about garbage. Yeah, it's all about shit, David. That's right. We took over the room right when it turned to shit. The whole fucking thing turned to crap. So Beefheart says, yeah, there's no point in getting into the bullshit to find out what the bull ate. That's Beefheart striking the set. Not going to put up with it anymore.
Beefheart said that joke. There's no need to get, what is it, the bullshit?
He made that up. No need to get into the bullshit to find out what the bull ate. That's actually anti-mediacology. We're supposed to get into the bullshit to find out the formal causality of it. Who made this shit? Where is it going to go? How is it going to be recycled for creativity? Beefheart said, forget it. Strike the set. We're not even going to bother analyzing it anymore.
But I remember when I first started listening to Ion, for me it was a big breakthrough that he said there is no more problem with radiation or chemtrails and pollution.
Right.
Yeah.
Like everything.
Well, why did you believe it? Roxy, why did you believe it? None of your friends are going to accept that statement. Why did you?
Well, because he's claiming it that the perfect cell can use anything as food, as
right.
nutrition. It can be processed, and it will actually be good for you in a way. Like
Did Ian say that? That the cell can use anything? Or he did say that about the eye cell, but that wasn't part of science.
Like, you could, for example, be irradiated and or had heavy metals in your body, and they will be processed by your body with no problem. As any other food, it will be digested or processed by the body and use what it can be used, and the rest will be...
But why did you believe this? I take it that you listened to Ion, like you were saying when you were seeing Dan Winter in 2010 when you're first listening. You deliberated on it. You said, okay, he's saying that. I don't know if that's true. And then you re-listened to it, gradually programmed yourself into believing it. Or the logic of it got through to you.
Well, the logic of the way he explained it as... all these things that seem to be bad are actually necessary for the creation of the new chemistry and the new environment.
Right. But that doesn't answer why did you believe it. You didn't believe it right away. You repeated your listening of it. Or Ian repeated himself each show a little bit. And that
it was very, very early in Iandom that this... thing with the when was Fukushima?
Fukushima was March 11th, 2011. When you were puking in Crete. Right? When you went to Crete. Wasn't that in March, April 2011?
Yes.
It was after your private session. And you had your private session in April. You started puking after the private session with Ion, right?
Yes.
You were trying to eliminate all the garbage. You actually became hyper worried about garbage. You would eat something and puke it back up. Did you have bulimia?
Yes, no. On the contrary, I enjoy eating.
But you did puke it up, and it wasn't... What?
I am a gourmand.
Gourmet. Right, so you knew you weren't trying to worry about your weight, but something else disgusted you, and you puked it up every day.
Yes, I don't know. I don't know what happened, but...
You had to ask Ion exactly what happened. You haven't asked that. You could ask Ion... Why did that? What was I expressing? Anyways, your digestive system is the ultimate, you know, garbage dump. Food is
yes,
processed.
From the the German medicine point of view, this new German medicine. I think when you throw up, it's because you don't want to accept. Whatever
Say that. The total total biology, yeah. So, Bert, if you want to get your course credit, you're going to have to speak a little more.
At the beginning, Ion talk a lot about this pollution, for example, and he really explained very good why Fukushima was not a big deal or this the oil in the Gulf of Mexico, there was also this big... spill of oil in the Gulf of Mexico. Do you remember?
That was in 2011 or so, maybe 2010, yes.
Yeah, it was big one.
But the way he explained how there was no problem with the radiation and the pollution, because we could actually, we needed actually these things for the creation of the new environment, or why there is no, it's not a, a big problem with all these fires, because we need the carbon. And he explained it so well that I just believe it.
You bought it.
I think.
You bought it.
Yeah,
you bought
I
it.
Think I needed to believe that it is so.
The Ion's presentation made sense when they described it about the environment. It just
right.
made sense how they paint the picture, how they laid it out, that it made a lot of sense. That the environment, the things that happened. Well, one part that was convincing is that they said that we've been told a lot of things that are bad for us that aren't really bad for us if we come into our
yes,
power.
Because that was one of the big things he was discussing at the beginning, that everything had become trash. Everything had become junk. Even the air, the water, the soil, everything is bad for your health. Everything is polluted. All the foods. At the end, he said, it's not like that. For example, you don't gain weight by eating, or you don't get sick by what you eat. It things work in a different way. It's, if you believe it, then you allow it somehow.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was thinking how the planet, everything was scrapped by the satellite environment, and then the information turnover of the Android meme made everything slower, and it all became crap. We were being seduced into thinking that everything was garbage or was negative, and eventually everything would be negative. That's where you end up like Dan Winter, you know, condemning air conditioners and whatever other things you mentioned, Roxy, about him. It's a hyper-neurosis. I mean, Carolyn had to deal with environmental allergies, I remember, in the 80s. You know, people couldn't breathe. I would say that the transparency of the satellite environment, it turned everything into like something shining through the cellophane globally, that disgust took over. The natural process of being creative based on finding garbage and then doing something worthwhile with it had sped up so much that people started to lose an accurate focus on what was garbage, and everything eventually appeared to be polluted. So
yeah.
The satellite environment made us think everything bad was bad, so the end environment of Ion had to come in and say, no, you're being seduced by the satellite effect, the fiber optic effect. Nothing is bad. You make it bad.
Well, and I think when you're still in the little man state, you start feeling this frequency that Ion says is becoming amplified, and it comes to a point where you cannot stand it anymore and you prefer to exit than to stay here. You cannot
Yeah, you turn yourself into garbage. If everything's a suicide, that means you've turned yourself into garbage. You want to flush yourself down the toilet. Go out, go somewhere else.
Yes, and your explanation, the labyrinth of the mind, says, oh, you are allergic to peanuts, you are lactose intolerant, this is the gluten, and whatever. Everybody has some type of allergy, like you said.
Right.
I remember the shock of Ion one time when someone called in and asked them about a sickness they had, and they had some type of an aversion of dirty water. And Ion told
right.
him to go get water that was not in pipes. And that you
right.
could hear and feel the brain fart that the guy had when Ion told him that, because he had no idea how he was going to do that. But Ion just purposely told him that because he had an aversion to dirt.
Right.
And that's a lot of what Ion picks up. as really an anti-environment is that when someone engages them, their bias of what they're for and against, and then ION automatically goes for what they know that the person's going to be against. So that's why it was, like Roxanna, I accepted the, I never worried about chemtrails. I saw them, but I never bothered them. But when ION presented that you want more of it, that was a little more accepting than just, you know, like most people being paranoid, like from the Project Camelot and Avalon crew who really promoted a lot about chemtrails being promoted. So it's refreshing with ION when ION presented that the pollution was not really pollution.
Yeah.
I think this is also the explanation why most of the population is on these cyclic drugs.
Oh, the what? Say it again.
What
psychic. How do you call this? Feel well.
Psychiatric.
Type of.
Prozac and all that.
Prozac and all these things.
Yeah.
What's That's your point really, you're saying about that? What's the pattern?
Yes, that a big part of the population, more than half the population, for example, in America or,
right.
or here, even all children have some type of medication.
You know what they're doing? They're turning their interior landscape into an art form. They're programming the environment. It's old garbage, so they put extra care on it. They're doing the WBH thing, falling back down into the rag and bone shop of the heart. The interior chemical body landscape is so garbaged that we have the right to alter it and make new art of it by taking a pill. That's the means. That's the medium. That's the paintbrush. I'm going to paint my insides with Prozac. You have to be able to play with the images of the body, the chemical body, to get a lot of these processes. You have to become flexible with your image. And then I am saying,
yes, they think this is the counterblast of this not feeling well in the new environment,
right.
The new frequencies, and they think this is the. They think that it's going to help them to stand and to.
Well, I say strike the set. Any garbage innovation is full of danger to the whole planet and ought to be prohibited, says Babo, rather than Plato.
Yes, and I remember when I started taking the drops, and I had a big fight with my ex-boyfriend because he said I was crazy to take something without knowing what it was.
Yeah.
And I said, you don't know what is in your food, really. You don't know what's in the air, what's in the water, really. You don't know.
Right.
And you're taking it. And I think in the situation we are, it's like, what can be worse? Anyway. It's like, at least.
Right. Yeah.
Let's see if this works.
That's right. Okay, so we just did the McLuhan-Dulein Volume 1, Number 11, for May 1969, called Strike the Set. So I have here, what was McLuhan doing this month when Strike the Set came out, May 69? He was invited to the Illuminati. He went to the Bilderbergers. What?
Yes, the Guardians of the Light.
The Guardians of the Light?
The carriers of the light.
Yeah, the carriers of light. So he goes to the Bilderbergers on May 14th. He comes back, and on May 14th, 1969, he writes this letter to the head of the Illuminati, Mr. Prince Bernhard. Oop, who's calling? I don't know that name. Better leave that. I'm going to touch it. So what do you say to the Illuminati? What would you say? I mean, this guy is running the very...
Well,
the trilateral commission.
Right in the light part.
Right, right. But not in the salt part. So
yeah.
I want to open the other people.
All participants are now unmuted.
Show no interest in the ambassador. And, oh, what's this? Oh, this is someone who is making an appointment. Yes, the ones not qualified to talk about McLuhan have not done the necessary homework. We're excluded over the last hour and a half, and I apologize for that. But everybody knows about the conspiracy, and so we would welcome your response to McLuhan teaching you what to say to the Illuminati when you're forced to have dinner with them. Let's see. All you guys, are you ready? You're all unmuted. Are you even there?
Oh, you can hear me?
Yes, Sarah. Big Sarah.
Okay. How come I got put on the bench?
Oh.
Coach?
Yeah. Well, I just want you to have the experience. I want you to experience it. Sarah, you get cut from the volleyball team.
I'm going to take my ball and go home. No.
Yeah, Sarah, now listen. Do you have some things you want to say about it? Well, we'll make an addendum.
Oh, yeah, I was just going to say my tagline on my email, beautify junkyards, throw something beautiful away today.
That's awesome. That's do you know where that comes from? Do you know the story where that comes from? It was a sign in Toronto at a junkyard. The junkyard, they advertised their junkyard by saying, beautify junkyards, throw away something beautiful today.
Yeah.
So they knew the planet was a junkyard.
Yeah. I love that.
Yeah, it's a beautiful quote.
Gerard Stern used it on his flyer. On his flyer when he was doing his first opening, I think, in San Francisco.
Back in the 60s? No, he didn't know. He didn't. That quote,
I don't
that
know,
quote was not available
I don't know when it was.
In 63.
Well, so I'll have to look at. I'm re-listening to those tapes. I'll find it when he used it. I'm not
right because Gerard is well. I guess I shouldn't say what he's doing, but he called in my services. He cited me as a reference, so mm-hmm. that the institution can call me. Will be calling me to. To see what I have to say about Gerard's junk, about Gerard's garbage.
Because he wants to sell it. They're going to they're going to offer him money for it?
Well, I don't want to say anything about it. This is personal business. I'm just pointing out that this is the first time someone as established in the art world as he has the acumen, the intelligence to bring me in. I mean, that's getting weird when I'm going to be cited as an authority for GERD's validation.
That's good.
Quite a compliment. So it's interesting you bring him up. So he sent me his poetry book that he did in 1965 called After Image. The original little booklet. Maybe someday I should read some of the poetry, but... Do you have any other ideas about this McLuhan stuff? That was a good quote. Beautiful. Help beautify junkyards.
What I was going to say...
Hey, you know what, Sarah? Sarah, hold on. You've got on your card, beautify junkyards. I think it's help beautify junkyards. Do you have the word help there?
Oh, no, I don't.
Yeah, I think it's better that way. Help beautify junkyards. Throw something beautiful away today. And I don't know if it's the word beautiful. Because he's repeating it twice. I don't know if that's good.
I saw it off the internet, but I'll go look again and see if I can find a different one. I don't know.
Yeah, just see if there is, because repeating the word beautiful, I don't know. Maybe that works. Okay,
in the very beginning, you were mentioning, how all of the writers that went before, the ones that come after, use what they have said and repackage it or whatever. And that's when I was reading that Harold Bloom, and he talks about this Apophrites, and that's exactly what that is. And it means return of the dead. And
Hippocrates? You mean the medical?
No, the word he, I think he made this word up. It's Apophrades, A-P-O-P-H-A-D-E-S. Oh, it doesn't have an R.
Okay.
Apophrades. I wonder if I spelled it right. Yeah, I think it's
Apophrades. And what is
that? It means the return of the dead.
Okay.
So it is describing that concept of writers building on the work that came before them. And that's
the anxiety of influence was the anxiety of influence
anxiety
was his
influence.
Theory.
Yeah. That's the book. That's the one I was just going to mention that. I can't remember what else I was going to say. When you were talking about garbage, you know, they have these pictures going around about the big, huge island in the Pacific that's supposed to be made out of garbage. And
yes.
Kind of a meme. Well,
yeah.
I researched that. It's not true. Those pictures that they have are from some dirty little bay in Singapore or somewhere. And so there's not really a big garbage island out there. There's a lot of plastic in the ocean, but it's not all in one place.
Right. And now, ION has been, you know, saying not a problem. And 2 years ago, the whaling tourist thing here was showing slideshows about it and getting Hawaiians worried about it. And ION said, nah, not an issue. Maybe it's not as big anymore because ION's breaking it up.
It's all broken up into little small pieces. I mean, there might be some bays that have all that plastic crap in them that are, you know, countries that throw their stuff in the ocean. But it's not out in the Pacific, and it's not that Pacific vortex. But there's they see plastic in the bellies of some dead birds, but they don't think it's killing birds. Some birds or fish are malnourished, and they have plastic in their bellies. But, it doesn't sound like it's a problem yet. It's slightly, it could throw the ecosystem out of balance at some point, but, you know, you're talking a lot of years for that to happen.
Right. Okay.
But anyway.
Thank you for your contribution there. Thank you, Sarah. Now, I'm going to keep it unmuted so I can hear people laughing when they feel like it, but this is what McLuhan writes to His Royal Highness Prince Bernard at Sustik Palace in The Hague, Holland, on May 14, 1969. This is his review of the wonderful Bilderberg Conference of the elites that Prince Bernard sponsored. He starts off, Your Royal Highness, it was good to be there. It is good to be back. As you know, I was a rather bad boy at Bilderberg. Now, would you say that to Mr. Luminati? I was rather a bad boy.
This is beginning to sound like your letter to Prince Charles.
Right. That's right. Memo to Prince. Yeah. I apparently broke all sub-genie guidelines and became a sub-deanie, and I apologize. So he goes, as you know, I was a rather bad boy at Bilderberg. Frankly, I was staggered at the very low level of awareness of the contemporary world exhibited by all the guests present. They had no awareness of the present. I was staggered at the very low level of awareness of the contemporary world exhibited by all the guests present. And I went... maybe some archive. I got the list of people at Bilderberg. I got some Bilderberg documents somewheres of that year. Or maybe I must have Xeroxed somebody, maybe in Toronto, the university put on display of his Bilderberger documents. So he goes, as my friend Wyndham Lewis, the painter, put it, quote, the artist is engaged in writing a detailed history of the future because he's the only person who lives in the present, unquote. So here he is speaking to the elite, and he's citing his old buddies again. You know, he's not being original. He just falls back, lazily falls back on the old quotes he's been writing for 10 years.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. He says that to everybody.
That's right. He's been saying it for 25 years. And he just has one thing to say to everybody on the planet. And he takes the time to get in touch with everybody or every media so that he can say what he... And he says, he had a line in Explorations, let me repeat what I was about to say. That sums it up. Let me repeat what I was about to say. And he says, ordinary people live 30 years back in a state of motivated somnambulism. Such was the state of the delegates at Bilderberg. Association with poets and painters of many lands have accustomed me to dealing with people of trained perceptions and contemporary awareness. Without a knowledge of all the poets and painters and artists from Baudelaire to Joyce, it is futile to attempt any appraisal of the formal or efficient causes initiated by the evolutionary extensions of our bodies, which we call technology. The paper readers, you know, the panelists, the paper readers, as well as the bankers and statesmen and educators present at Bilderberg, had undergone no perceptual training. They were men of a few simple, old-fashioned... This is what I would say to Randy Boggins. You people over there listening to off-planet radio are men of a few simple, old-fashioned concepts. As a colonial, in other words, not an American, as a colonial, I had nourished the illusion that Alex Jones and alternative media were aware of the contemporary arts as necessary guides to change. My disillusion was total when I was interviewed by you, Mr. Moggins. The delegates at Off-Radio Planet, whatever it is, Off-Planet Fuck-Up, or at Genesis Broadcasting Corporation, or whatever Alex Jones, what's his name, George? I was aware that Art Bell had a standard, but since Art Bell has left Mr. George Norrie, your guests were embalmers, and he has E-M-B-A-L-M-E-R-S. That means funeral stuff, right?
Yeah.
Freezing the body. But he puts in brackets embalmers, E-M-B-O-M-B-E-R-S. These people at Coast to Coast are embalmers of a dead past. They live in a rearview mirror blowing both horns of their dilemma. tell you. As a colonial, I had nourished the illusion that Europeans at least were aware of the contemporary arts as necessary guides to change. My disillusion was total. The delegates at Bilderberg were embalmers of a dead past. In other words, they were bombing a dead past. They live in a rearview mirror, blowing both horns of their dilemmas. Dilemmas is plural. Then he says, the great advantage in participating in Bilderberg is that it gives one a means of estimating the level to which the incompetence of the participants has enabled them to attain. he got a good bead on how stupid everybody was by going to this conference. He had a new insight. And this is right when the Peter principle, every man rises to his level of incompetence, so he's applying it here. The great advantage in participating in Bilderberg is that it gives one a means of estimating the level to which the incompetence of their participants has enabled them to attain. So he was turning the junk of these chemical body brains into an art form. He was studying the junk gathered at Bilderberg as he watched them try to get their shit together. Then he says, every man has a right to protect his own ignorance. However, these men are responsible for coping with a changing world, which has sent them scurrying for cover in the opposite direction of the changes that we have released. I ask them to instance a single example in human history of any community that had been able to foresee the consequences of any innovation. The group was unable to comply. When I explained that in terms of services available to the ordinary man in 1830, England at least had achieved communism, they were unable to demur. He's saying they were speechless. They couldn't disagree with him. That observation concerned the old-fashioned industrial hardware only. When travel and information and education services are available to the ordinary person, the services that the greatest private wealth could not possibly provide for itself, that is communism. It happened long before Karl Marx. Such service environments are invisible to accountants and actuaries and bankers who deal in double entries and political arithmetic, which conceal technological and environmental realities completely. So the accounting, double entries, that means cheating, and political arithmetic do not deal with the current technological and environmental realities. Today, with the multi-billion dollar service environments available to everybody, almost for free, in brackets, these include the massive educational and informational world of advertising, it means that we have plunged very deep into tribal communism on a scale unknown in human history. So I asked the group, quote, what are we fighting communism for? We are the most communist people in world history, unquote. Then he says, there is not a single demur. In other words, nobody like me, like all the great artists, nobody fucking responds, as I complain often here, right? they're putting up with this. You had to put up with this silence. Somebody to say, this fucking McClellan is a fucking nut, man. So then he says,
oh my gosh.
Like he's always trying to look at the positive. It was really interesting meeting such dumb people. That was a great advantage. I didn't realize that awareness had been so stupid. Then he says, another fringe benefit, but he calls it one. One fringe benefit of the conference for me was the sudden realization of what is meant by class war. It means people deprived of identity. It is only accidentally the result of poverty. Today, the entire TV generation has been deprived of its identity by the new image, reference Hertz's law, quote, the consequence of the images will be the image of the consequences. We quoted that from the Dew Line. He's always using that quote. It is the affluent young today who are fighting the new class war. Marxism is quite unable to cope with any 20th century problem. The so-called communist countries are merely trying to have a 19th century of consumer goods. Witness the cargo cults of the backward lands. I hope you will correct the unfortunate space arrangements which the participants at the conference had to endure with the consequent loss of dialogue. So now he's criticizing the environment of the chairs and how the chairs are set up. If I appear to be rude, it is because I am not addressing myself to persons, but to issues of great urgency. So he's saying, I'm not addressing you, Prince Bernhard. I'm addressing the big issues that I've been addressing and repeating myself for 15 years. Issues of great urgency. Naturally, I appreciate the splendid urbanity with which you conducted the proceedings. I'm honored to have been a participant, Your Royal Highness. Most cordial thanks for your hospitality at Bilderberg. So he had no complaint about the chemical body, cliche ritual of the conference. But as for producing anything of significance, it was a disaster. And only he got the real insight that the class war was being run by teenagers.
And, you know, you had to actually send the letter, you know, to Your Royal Highness. Your whole group's a bunch of fuck-ups. But I did enjoy myself. It was quite fun.
Yeah. I asked him, any response? He said, nope. Bernhard, he did not. And within 10 years, he was in jail, Mr. Bernhard. He got into a big, it was called the Lockheed bribery scandal. I don't know if he went to jail, but he got in big trouble. He just faded off. Probably was the Bolsheviks were nailing him, and he'd be part of the old Rockefeller Network. Let's look him up. Let's see what the garbage of Wiki will tell me.
What year was the letter, Bob? The year that he wrote that, sent that letter.
It's 1969. 1969. The very month that we read this, you know, Dew Line, Strike the Set. It's from the same month.
And you were just comparing at the beginning of the letter, you know, Randy Moggins, you know, Art Bell, George Norrie, Alex Jones. Well, Alex Jones has spent, what, the last 5 to 7 years trying to infiltrate the
Bilderbergs,
you know, and so it's kind of like a bit of a slap in his face. Like, well, McLuhan got this right back in '69, and now you're here trying to get into something that's been obsolete for a really long time.
That's right. So I pull up Prince Bernhard, and there's the headline: pathological liar, Nazi background, and his part in. In his part in starting the Bilderberg conferences. So he was a member of the Nazi Party, created his own myths. So he was a big bad boy, and McLuhan outdid him. McLuhan made himself a batter boy. Imagine walking into a Nazi enclave, walking into Hitler's bunker. and saying, I'm sorry, yesterday I was rather a bad boy. and then Hitler asks you, how were you a bad boy? And you explain what you did badly, and nobody understands. Nobody disagrees. What are you talking about? Where's the hidden ground here?
That was eloquent.
That was what?
That was eloquent, the way McLuhan did it. You know, I'm
yes.
going to slap you on both sides of the face, but I seriously doubt you're going to understand or feel it, but here you go.
Well, now, I've said this before, if you've heard everything, you should have heard this, but there were some great anecdotes. The president of the University of Toronto, Claude, forget his name, me and Nelson had a meeting with him, and he was so impressed with our McLuhan knowledge. Yeah, Claude Bissell, he's the one who was the administrator that gave McLuhan the Center for Culture and Technology. So he's an important guy giving prestige to McLuhan. He had been an English professor, so he knew McLuhan in the English department, was impressed with McLuhan. So he was telling me he's the one, he being a real normal member of the establishment, he's the one who got McLuhan to speak at Bilderberg. So he told us these various things he encountered. When he danced with Prince Bernhard's wife, Queen Beatrice, or Beatrice, whatever the queen was back then, it's a different name now, he told her, while dancing, he told her Polish jokes, and she was Polish.
Oh, my God.
I mean, this guy is a manipulative. This is like the worst guy on a New York subway who attacks everybody. This is what McLuhan really was. Bissell was amazed at that. Then he said, they were on the plane flying back, and George Ball was the policy creator for Nixon, who had just got elected. Nixon was just coming back into office. It was his first victory as president, his first term. What did he do? Yeah, his first term. So George Ball had to formulate the Vietnam policy. So Claude Bissell watched McLuhan. He knew these guys were on the plane. He never, you know, stopped being on duty. He walks up to George Ball's seat, probably in first class, and he asked him, "What are you writing?" And he said, "Oh, I'm writing our policy for Vietnam." And McLuhan, Bissell said, went into an amazing explanation of how Vietnam for America was Custer's last stand. And he explained how obsolete George Ball's project was and his administration and Nixon were, and they were going to get in big trouble. Probably even cited the Pueblo incident to him. He totally, you know, insulted Ball on even on having any understanding of what they were up against. And he said, it's Custer's last stand. You guys are going to go down.
Okay.
So he did that to Mr. Ball on the airplane. Back at the Bilderberg conference, before he flew out, he had another time where he was talking to, I think, Dean Rusk, who was the famous Secretary of Defense for LBJ or something, another big heavy. And Dean Rusk was complaining that Trudeau, who had just become Prime Minister, was not really supporting Nixon for the Vietnam effort. Trudeau was a liberal something and certainly wasn't going to be pro-Vietnam. That wouldn't be good for his image. And Canada was supposed to be a peacemaker. So Dean Rusk complains to McLuhan that your premier, your president, what do you call him, your prime minister is really falling short here and is going to get in trouble. So McLuhan, Bissell said, proceeded to explain to Mr. Dean Rusk that Canada was the borderline case, up against at least five different borders. They had the borders with the natives, the borders with the French, the borders with America, the borders with the Soviet Union, and maybe a couple other borders. He says, we deal with too many borders. We're involved in all parts of the planet. We can't take a specialist point of view. We can't take sides. We're in the middle of the whole thing. And Dean Rusk, of course, was appalled and probably didn't understand it. But McLuhan nailed every one of them.
You know, in the book of letters, there's another somebody from a university relations person must have written asking his opinion about a title of an article, News Media and College Unrest. And, and McLuhan fires back and he says, "Dear Mr. Carey, apropos proposed title, News Media and College Unrest, it tells all, i.e., would the unrest be less if the news coverage were less? The answer is yes. If wars were never even mentioned in any media whatever, there wouldn't be any. By the same token, if the slaughterhouses were all on media every day, meat would disappear from our diet at once. Photographic news coverage killed public hangings. TV coverage makes the Viet business difficult to get on with. May I suggest, therefore, that we add another dimension to the topic by saying old and new media and student unrest. The interface between print culture and electric culture not only creates student unrest, it creates collapse of all existing organizations in business and other establishments of the world."
Wow. I don't know. Where do you get that letter? Is that in Letters?
Yeah,
book?
It's in Letters. It's in 1969
that.
As well. It's just a
69.
Short letter to this guy named Carey.
He basically was saying everything's disappeared. You know, when I replayed McLuhan's Killing, I was saying everything. He's saying it's apocalypse everywhere. Every establishment has collapsed. And people weren't going to buy that. They didn't believe it was that late. But he was right. And what was the first part? The simple solution is don't give anything any coverage.
Yeah.
And so he always
or you can create
serious.
Something. Everything's created in the media.
All we have to do is turn off TV.
Yeah. Or if you want to shut down the meat industry, you just show the slaughterhouses.
Right.
So that's pretty much what happens now, just like the big plastic island, which is fake, you know.
The big what? The plastic island, right.
The big fake plastic island in the Pacific.
Yeah. Yep.
Funny.
Do you remember this? What was the solution for the kids not studying Shakespeare and having an interest in reading the plays, the whole curriculum, the old Gutenberg curriculum for kids, he said all you have to do is just take the literature that they read, comics, magazines, movie journals, and whatever, that pop culture, and examine them on that content rather than testing them on Shakespeare. He said that'll stop them reading the junk literature immediately. And he said... And then he says, the fact that I've been saying this for 50, he was saying this in 68, he says, the fact that I've been telling you people, he was speaking to a teacher's associate, I've been telling you this for 15 years and you guys haven't adopted any response to what I'm saying, haven't used it, means that you people aren't serious. He's always telling people they weren't as serious as he was, and yet he was the most, outrageous joker. prankster. But he could defend his case. He had an answer if they want an answer. We got the solution here.
Right.
So, you can see by hanging around with McLuhan, I learned a lot about what was going to happen to me. I say that people are not serious if they don't engage Ion. And Ion being the biggest prankster going, but still got to engage him.